Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Tonight we discuss Zionism, which to our speaker, Jamie Jackson, who is an active supporter of Citizens for Justice in the Middle East, Unitarian Universalists for Justice in the Middle East, and Jewish Voice for Peace, believes is long overdue. Jackson asserts that to simply discuss and debate Zionism publicly is rarely done due to fears that such a discussion may be considered anti-Semitic, effectively shutting down any and all discussion of Zionism. Jackson believes that balanced debate and critique of the Zionist philosophy opens the door for finding new solutions for a peaceful and just resolution of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Jackson is a native of Kansas City and a member of All Souls. This show is recorded on April 22nd at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show begins with the speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Good morning. I'm George Baggett. I'm with the Forum Committee. Welcome to All Souls Unitarian Church Forum. The Forum's mission is to afford a platform for discussion of significant issues, especially those that involve ethical values in a contemporary world, and to promote critical thinking. This morning I have the privilege of introducing Ms. Jamie Jackson, an All Souls member for many years. Ms. Jackson holds a BA and MA from KU and has been a member of the Citizens for Justice in the Middle East since 2014. Is on the taboo about the discussion of Zionism rather than the alleged human rights violations. Ms. Jackson.
All right. Well, good morning. I want to thank the Forum Committee for giving me this opportunity to talk with you. It's an honor to be here to share my understanding about the suppression of the debate on Zionism. So this morning I will begin with a brief history of Zionism and how it is primarily understood today, and then we will look at ways in which public debate is being suppressed and why that suppression is dangerous for our democracy in the United States. My focus this morning is not on whether we should support Zionism or not support Zionism. My focus is on the need for an open debate. Historically, there have been other ideologies excluded from public debate in this country. So just 60 years ago, we all know that people were persecuted if they advocated for communism. McCarthyism caused academics, writers, Hollywood directors, and others to lose their jobs just on the mere suspicion that they were communist. McCarthyism was a stain on American democracy. People were persecuted based on peaceful ideological beliefs. Fortunately, today, we no longer tolerate the suppression of public debate about communism. Nevertheless, today, debate about Zionism is being suppressed. That suppression is what we will consider today. I will open with a brief history of Zionism and then consider evidence that it is a taboo topic in the mainstream media and on university campuses. So, what is Zionism? In part, Zionism is the call for Jews to return to their ancestral homeland. As a religious aspiration, it has been a recurring theme for generations of Jews. For example, Passover and Yom Kippur prayers traditionally conclude with next year in Jerusalem. But in the late 19th century, Zionism's call for a return to the Jewish homeland became a more predominantly political ideology that advocated the founding of a nation state, the State of Israel, quote, a Jewish state. This call for a nation state for Jews came in response to more extreme nationalist movements that were sweeping across Europe at the time that were promoting physical violence against Jews. The movement for a Zionist state was boosted by the Dreyfus Affair, the 1894 prosecution of Albert Dreyfus, a military officer in France, for treason. So many European Jews, assimilated Jews, were shocked by the trial, which relied on ugly Jewish stereotypes to convict Dreyfus. When the Austro-Hungarian Theodor Herzl saw Dreyfus's Jewishness used successfully to scapegoat him, Herzl determined that the only means for Jews to escape anti-Semitism in Europe would be the creation of a Jewish state where Jews could take refuge. Under Herzl's leadership, the World Zionist Organization held its first Congress in 1897, and Zionism ever since has been the political aspiration for a Jewish nation-state. Now, again, a primary impetus for creating a Jewish nation-state came from the persecution of Jews. And we all know that in the 20th century, the Nazi concentration camps and the Holocaust occurred so recently that perhaps you even know someone personally, or your grandparents escaped or survived the camps. And because of this historical persecution, advocates of Zionism today often express a belief that Jews need their own nation state as a refuge. And as a consequence of this belief, any challenge to the ideology of Zionism, any questioning of Zionism, inevitably evokes protestations about Jews' safety. And oftentimes, a challenge by critics of Zionism is met with accusations of anti-Semitism. Supporters of Zionism believe that Jews would not be safe without the refuge of a Zionist state. And we will be exploring these concerns a little later in my talk. So then, during World War I, the support for a Jewish homeland took a giant leap forward. For 400 years, Palestine had been part of the Ottoman Empire. It was inhabited by about 500,000 people, mostly Muslim and Christian Arabs, along with several thousand Jews. By 1917, as the war was coming to a close, the British ousted the Ottoman Empire from Palestine, which was then put under British control. The British Foreign Secretary, Lord Balfour, then issued his landmark Balfour Declaration of 1917. This document expressed the British government's support for, quote, the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, unquote, while expressly stating that the Jewish home should not, quote, prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, unquote. So this is 1917, just 20 years after the first Zionist Congress. And then during the 1930s, while the area was under what was called the British Mandate, the conflict between Arabs and the Arab community and Jews began to escalate over the question of immigration. Jews did not want to compromise on immigration because they saw Israel-Palestine as a means to escape persecution. Arabs did not want to compromise because Jewish migration could threaten their majority status in Palestine. So in the past, Arabs had seen Jews as basically peaceful neighbors, but now Palestinians began to see the new Jewish arrivals as people who wanted to seize their land. And then the Nazi persecution of Jews that began in the 1930s obviously compounded the problem. The British tried to limit Jewish migration to Palestine, restricting the number of Jews allowed to migrate to just 75,000 over 5 years. The British also imposed restrictions on purchases of land by Jews. Many of us are familiar, I am, with the film, the 1960 film, Exodus. The film portrays in emotional and sympathetic terms Zionist efforts to get as many Jews as possible into Palestine in order to influence the 1948 vote by the United Nations. The British are portrayed as villains, and the Arab viewpoint is discounted. As we all know, the United Nations voted to recognize part of Palestine as a Jewish state, and on May 14, 1948, Israel declared its independence. Since 1948, Israel has conquered most of the rest of Palestine. Since 1967, Israel has occupied the West Bank and Gaza and keeps Gaza under siege. This has exposed Israel to considerable criticism which has raised questions about the very nature of Zionism. So here you can see, if you want, the changes in who controlled the territory over the years. In response to this criticism of Zionism, attempts have been made to squelch public discussion. As we will see, the word Zionism is not always articulated either by those trying to open up the debate or by those trying to suppress the debate. It's true that there are ultra-Orthodox Jews who specifically assert their opposition to Zionism in public debate. And actually, there's a synagogue in Chicago that specifically calls itself non-Zionist. But most discussion about Zionism is camouflaged. One side points to violations of Palestinian human rights without necessarily talking about Zionist ideology, and others respond to criticism of Israel as an attack on Israel's right to exist, by which they mean Israel's right to be a Zionist state. Public discussion is shut down when supporters of Palestinian human rights are accused of being anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, or even anti-Jewish. Our understanding of violations of Palestinian human rights inevitably touches on whether we support Zionism, but the word Zionism is often left out of the discussion. The camouflaged arguments between supporters and critics of Zionism inevitably produces confusion, not clarity. So one excellent book that helps us untangle the confusion is Eve Spangler's Understanding Israel-Palestine. Dr. Spangler is a sociology professor at Boston University, and she sheds light on the dilemma that's facing Zionists. She writes that Zionism wants three things for the state of Israel: land, democracy, and a Jewish state. But she argues, although Israel can have any two of those things, it can't fit in all three. To realize all three goals, land, democracy, and a Jewish state, is logically impossible, and she explains why. Choice number one, Israel can choose to have all the land from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River, land that was once comprised Palestine, and still be a Jewish Zionist state. However, to be a Jewish state, Israel cannot allow non-Jews to vote and enjoy equal democratic rights. Non-Jews in Israel have never enjoyed equal rights, and ever since 1967, the vast majority of Palestinians have been cordoned off into what amounts to open-air prisons in Gaza and the West Bank. This is the current status quo. Israel is a Jewish state and controls all the land, but it is not a democracy. Choice number two is Israel can be a democracy and a Jewish Zionist state, but then it must give up some of the land. Part of the land would be a Zionist democratic state, while another part would be a Palestinian state. This is the two-state solution, a choice that becomes increasingly improbable as settlers illegally seize more and more territory that is supposed to be part of the Palestinian state. Choice number three, Israel can have all the land and be a democracy, but then it will not remain a Zionist state. If all the inhabitants across all the land were given democratic voting rights, the laws favoring Jews would not hold. This is the so-called one-state solution. So again, choice number one is the current status in Israel-Palestine. Israel rules all the land according to the laws that favor Jews and denies democratic rights to Palestinians. That is why debate about Palestinian human rights is perceived as an existential threat by many supporters of Zionism. Israel claims to be a democracy, but in fact there are millions of Palestinians in Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem who do not enjoy democratic rights, while the small percentage of Palestinians who are Israeli citizens lack many rights that Israeli Jews enjoy. Not to mention the more than 700,000 Palestinian refugees who either fled or were pushed out of their land in 1948 and are now prevented from returning and reclaiming land stolen from them. And with the continual recognition of more illegal settlements, more Palestinian land is stolen. So, to reiterate, Zionism can continue if Israel withholds democratic rights for its Palestinian inhabitants, Zionism can also continue if a separate Palestinian state is allowed to coexist with the state of Israel. On the other hand, if the occupation ends and all the inhabitants live under one nation state, that nation will not likely be Zionist. So now let's turn to the evidence that a public debate about Zionism is being suppressed. To understand the suppression of debate, we first need to understand how the debate is framed. A debate about Zionism is substantially about the morality of a nation state giving legal preference to one group over another, whether that preference is grounded in race, ethnicity, or religion. Israel has always justified giving Jews human rights that are denied to non-Jews. So to debate about Zionism is to address this issue of Israeli policy. Consequently, any criticism of Zionism is received by many Zionists as an existential threat to Israel, an attack on Israel's very right to exist. So now let's look at just two places where a free and open discussion about Zionism and the conflict in Israel-Palestine is suppressed. Those two places are universities and the media. So first, universities. There are really countless examples of speech being shut down in universities when that speech defends Palestinian human rights. One recent example is the focus of an ongoing lawsuit between students and the administration at Fordham University. Fordham is a well-respected academic institution whose mission statement affirms its commitment to freedom of inquiry and the quest for truth. And yet, when Fordham students followed all the university rules in their application to form a club investigating Palestinian rights, Fordham denied the application. Fordham justified its rejection of the application by saying the club would stir up too much controversy. In what one newspaper called the biggest free speech fight in the country over Palestinian activism, students have filed a lawsuit to uphold the right to free expression, and that lawsuit is still pending. So another example, when University of California students peacefully protested a campus talk by former Israeli soldiers, University President Mark Udoff likened the students' peaceful protest to hanging nooses and drawing swastikas. Really? A peaceful protest is like hanging nooses and drawing swastikas? The University of California attacked the morality of students engaging in peaceful protest, seemingly because the protest was aimed at Israeli violations of human rights. And in an example closer to home, in the spring of 2015, the Missouri History Museum decided, after receiving complaints from Israel advocacy organizations, that an event on solidarity between activists working for justice in Ferguson, Mexico, and Palestine could not go forward unless organizers removed references to Palestine. The event was banned because it expressed solidarity with Palestinians. Action to shut down speech about Palestinians' grievances is so common that it now has a name, the Palestinian Exception, Progressive Except Palestine, PEP. Free speech is encouraged except when speech questions Israeli policies and practices toward Palestinians. So now I want to take a final example, one that links censorship in the universities with one-sided view in the mainstream media. Last year, the New York Times made Barry Weiss an op-ed writer for the paper. In 2003, the Times had described Barry Weiss as, quote, a pro-Israel Columbia sophomore who is a co-founder of Columbians for Academic Freedom, unquote. Sounds great, right? This description sugarcoats the many smear campaigns led by Barry Weiss against professors at Columbia who criticized Israel, campaigns that the New York Civil Liberties Union characterized as witch hunts. The targets of her smear campaigns have been overwhelmingly Muslim and or Arab. in one incredibly ugly campaign at Columbia University, the film Columbia Unbecoming depicted Arab professors as oppressors of Jewish students. Barry Weiss herself credits this campaign as having catalyzed her interest in journalism. And her attacks on Muslim and Arab professors weren't limited to the Columbia campus. She also participated in a campaign to destroy the reputation of an Arab-American academic who was about to receive tenure at Barnard. After her book was published, showing having anthropological findings that cast doubt on Israel's claim to biblical entitlement of the land, suddenly a petition written by an Israeli settler showed up, accusing and demanded that the professor be denied tenure, accusing her of defaming Israel based on ignorance and shoddy scholarship. And then, with no training or expertise whatsoever in anthropology, Barry Weiss joined the attack, calling the book anti-Zionist propaganda. The settler's petition ended up being ultimately discredited, and the professor was eventually given tenure at Barnard. And Barry Weiss was given a position as op-ed writer for the New York Times. The Times not only made Barry Weiss an op-ed writer last year, the Times held her up as a tribute to the newspaper's commitment to diversity. So let's think about that diversity. We should note that the Times editorial page currently does not have a single female minority columnist. And despite writing frequently about the conflicts in the Middle East, the Times does not have a single regular Arab-American or Muslim-American writer. The Times does have multiple pro-Israel columnists, and many columnists, editors, and bureau chiefs with strong personal ties to Israel. So, for example, columnist David Brooks has a son in the military, in the Israeli military. Isabel Kirshner, who is the correspondent in the newspaper's Jerusalem Bureau, says her son is in the Israeli army. Ethan Bronner, the Times Israel-Palestine Bureau chief, has a son in the Israeli military. One Jerusalem-based bureau chief recently explained, quote, "Bronner's situation is the rule, not the exception. I can think of a dozen foreign bureau chiefs responsible for covering both Israel and the Palestinians who have served in the Israeli army, and another dozen who, like Bronner, have kids in the Israeli army," unquote. And the bureau chief added, quote, "It is common to hear Western reporters boasting to one another about their Zionist credentials, their service in the Israeli army, or the loyal service of their children," unquote. So this is all just in evidence of perhaps not a lack of bias. Now, as promised earlier, I want to say a few words about the obstacles to an open discussion about Zionism. Since Zionism is received as an existential threat, discussion about Zionism is received as an existential threat to Israel, let's ask ourselves two important questions. One, does the current situation in Israel, Palestine, make Jews more safe or less safe? And two, can we justify the oppression of another people to hold on to some notion of a safe place for ourselves for future events? Fear that Jews will not be safe without a Jewish homeland in Israel is understandable and widespread. Jews have been persecuted over the millennia. Let's consider Zionism's relation to this fear today. Roger Cohen, a columnist for the Times, in his column earlier this year, meditated on this very question by weighing the price paid by Palestinians, a price that includes stolen lands, stolen homes, refugees stranded for generations in camps, ethnic cleansing that continues today, loss of basic human rights, and life in an open-air prison that strangles any chance for Gazans to prosper. And here's what Roger Cohen says about that price. Quote, "What of the price paid? Put a gun to my head, or rather my heart, and I will say, as a Jew, that, yes, Israel was worth the price. The Jews needed a homeland. History proves that. Assimilation never worked. The Holocaust was no more than a culmination. The United Nations in 1947 backed such a homeland. And if I, as a Jew, have lived a privileged life in the diaspora, it is in part because of the pride and strength that the new Jew of Israel forged. Never again became more than mere words through Israel's might, unquote. So let's repeat. The price Roger Cohen refers to is a price paid by Palestinians. But for him, as a Jew, Israel was worth the price. Roger Cohen is a sincere liberal Zionist and echoes a belief held by many Zionists. But do we accept a need for Israel to be brutal so that all Jews can be safe? In the online magazine Mondo Weiss, Philip Weiss answers with a resounding no. And he offers two reasons. One, today Israel's conduct in the name of the Jewish people is arguably endangering Jews around the world. So Weiss argues that Israel's egregious violations of Palestinian human rights creates more anti-Semitism. One spokesman in the moderate J Street organization warned that Israel's never-ending occupation is not only deepening the despair of Palestinians, it is also making the lives of Jews worldwide more precarious. The second obstacle to a discussion about Zion is, imagine if we applied Cohen's principle to other peoples. Is it defensible for any group of people to choose to make itself safe by ethnically cleansing another group? The second obstacle to a discussion about Zionism rests on the public's misunderstanding. The relationships between Zionism, Palestinian human rights, democratic values, and free speech have been badly misconstrued. To a large extent, we can blame the media in this country, media which overwhelmingly present the Israeli viewpoint. An excellent exposé of this misinformation from the media is the film Occupation of the American Mind, Israel's Public Relations War in the United States. The film will be shown here at All Souls, right here in Bragg Auditorium, on Thursday, May 3rd at 6:15 for an event sponsored by our own Social Responsibility Board, All Souls Social Responsibility Board. This film, which has been shown at many other Unitarian churches across the country, exposes how identical talking points are used to describe the conflict between Israel and Palestinians, and how repetition of these talking points by politicians and by the media has created a one-sided, unbalanced understanding among Americans. The talking points are largely facilitated by Israeli politicians who choose words to create the most sympathy for Israelis and the harshest criticism of Palestinians. Then the talking points are taken up by politicians here in the U.S. and by the mainstream media. This is not some conspiracy theory. Governments, of course, try to present events in a light favorable to them. The problem comes when the mainstream media parrots the talking points of one side of a conflict while giving minimal coverage to the other side. The media failed to challenge the talking points. In the United States, the Israeli lobby has such influence over our politicians that they dare not question these talking points. Journalists and politicians in other countries, Germany, France, and Great Britain, have a much more balanced presentation of events in Israel and Palestine. They have been willing to publicly challenge statements when Israeli politicians gloss over violations of Palestinian human rights. So, by the way, the May 3rd film event will be followed by a panel discussion giving all sides the opportunity to ask questions and voice their concerns. So one pushback against the one-sided message from our media is what's referred to as BDS, the BDS movement. BDS stands for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. The BDS movement is a global grassroots campaign promoting various forms of boycott against Israel until it meets what the campaign describes as Israel's obligations under international law. And those are withdrawal from the occupied territories, removal of the wall in the West Bank, full equality for non-Jewish citizens of Israel, and promotion of the right of return of Palestinian refugees. The BDS campaign, organized and coordinated by the Palestinian BDS National Committee, was started in 2005 by over 170 Palestinian non-governmental organizations in support of the Palestinian cause, citing a host of UN resolutions and specifically referencing the anti-apartheid campaigns against white minority rule in the apartheid era of South Africa. Protests and conferences in support of the campaign have been held in a number of countries around the world, and the boycott, divestment, sanction movement is worldwide and gaining momentum. Again, it is a nonviolent, peaceful form of protest. Support for political boycott has been recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court as a form of free speech. So what has been the consistent response to BDS movement by politicians in the United States? At least 26 states have passed anti-BDS legislation, penalizing anyone who supports boycotts of Israel. I like to call these laws gag bills because they take away our First Amendment right to free speech. With the help of the ACLU, a teacher successfully challenged the Kansas gag bill in court, and the Kansas court ruled that the gag bill is unconstitutional. And yet, Missouri legislators are nevertheless planning to pass a similar gag bill penalizing those who support a boycott of Israel. In the U.S. Congress, a proposed gag bill will impose a fine of up to $1 million on anyone who supports a boycott of Israel. Again, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that boycotts are political speech. These laws restricting citizens' right to free speech in the form of a political boycott are prohibited by the First Amendment. And yet the Israeli lobby's fear of boycotts is so great that it continues to press U.S. politicians for more laws that continue to be passed. These gag bills certainly inhibit an open discussion about Zionism. They are part of the chokehold on debate. So just this week, I ran into some comments by a woman named Leon Gale on Zionism and BDS that were so compelling for me that I want to include them here. Gail was a panelist earlier this month at the annual conference of J Street, a middle-of-the-road organization that lobbies about Israel-Palestine conflict. Leanne Gale has very deep roots in the Jewish community, from her childhood education in a Jewish day school to leadership roles in high school, college campus, Israel, and in the U.S. with the National Council of Jewish Women. She is currently a law student at Yale and hopes to move back to Israel to be a human rights attorney. She describes herself as a feminist and an anti-occupation activist. She acknowledged the risk to her personal and professional goals by speaking out about BDS and Zionism, given that the Israeli government has begun to turn people away from the country who support BDS. But here's one of her thoughts. She said, "I think that one of the major successes of the campaign against the BDS, which our communal institutions have put millions of dollars into, has been tamping down our ability to actually think about these issues because we are too afraid to even voice some of our thoughts in public for fear of our complete excommunication from our community." Unquote. And later, after referring to the panel's discussion on two of the issues at stake for a solution to the conflict, Gail fervently commented on a third issue, equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel. Quote, "And I actually think that that may be the most threatening plank of the BDS movement to many of us in the American Jewish community, because it really gets to the heart of Zionism itself. It really gets to the heart of, do we believe deep down that there can be a Jewish and democratic state? As I was walking here this morning, I was thinking, it can't be that the folks in this room have never just wondered to themselves, can it really be that a Jewish state that is dependent on maintaining a demographic majority of Jews at all cost can forever be a democracy? Can maintain liberal, democratic values? I think that's the real question. And I think to marginalize the BDS movement actually is an excuse for us to avoid that question and avoid figuring out, do we think that can actually be true?" Unquote. So then Gail made some more compelling observations about Zionism and anti-Semitism. So one, in the past, there have been several other intellectual and political movements in resistance to anti-Semitism. And for many years, the Reform movement was not a Zionist movement. But she makes an argument in her comments that Zionism is not the only way to work to combat anti-Semitism. And then two, she said many Jews, and Gail included herself, are questioning if Zionism is the best strategy to fight anti-Semitism. And three, Jewish institutions are putting many millions of dollars into passing these anti-BDS legislation that is tamping down on civil society in very damaging ways. So, well, that's one young Jew sounding an alarm on the chokehold on debate and how that chokehold on debate harms democracy. There is clearly a chokehold on public debate about Zionism, and the damage to democracy falls into two main categories. First, free speech. Free speech, the very First Amendment to our Constitution, lies at the heart of democracy. Whether debate is suppressed by the mainstream media, by university administrators, or by politicians, passing anti-BDS legislation. When free speech is infringed, democracy suffers. And second, the chokehold on public debate directly impacts public policy here in the United States. Public policy, not only about Israel per se, but also about U.S. domestic and foreign policy. The U.S. supports Israel's government with almost $4 billion every year. Money that goes mainly to Israel's military. Money that could be going to domestic problems in the U.S. Furthermore, the influential pro-Israel lobby helped push the U.S. to invade Iraq with disastrous results that continue even today. Okay, so what can you do? Well, I urge you to talk to others in your circle of friends and acquaintances about Zionism. Talk to your church, your synagogue, your university group, your work group, your family. Help knock the topic of Zionism off the taboo table. I invite you to join a group I belong to, Citizens for Justice in the Middle East. You can find out more about us on our Facebook page or on our webpage, cjme.org. If you attend the General Assembly of the Unitarians this June here in Kansas City, I will be hosting a class about Zionism on Friday evening, June 24th. And I heartily invite you to come to our film event Thursday, May 3rd at 6:15 right here in Bragg Auditorium at All Souls Unitarian Church. The film provides an excellent starting point for educating ourselves about the distorted media coverage related to Zionism. A panel discussion following the film will allow the audience to ask questions and voice their concerns. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your attention.
voting. I'd like to remind everybody that we're asking for questions here and not statements. If you have some statements and some opinions that you'd like to share later, you're more than welcome to come to the library to discuss those items, and Jamie has agreed to stay around for about 30 minutes after the talk.
Do you believe that the credibility of your presentation may be diminished by the fact that you don't mention any of the violence by people in Gaza toward Israel, or the shelling of Israel from the Golan Heights and other actions, the Intifada? You do not mention any of that, and my view is that this diminishes your credibility.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that comment. Let me let you know what my thought was as I was preparing the speech. As I emphasized at the beginning of the speech, this speech is not about all the bad things that Israel might have done, or all the bad things that Palestinians might have done and are doing. It's not about taking sides about who is to blame or who is not to blame. I stayed away from that deliberately. So you're right, I did not talk about any actions by Palestinians that could be used as a justification for, maybe the wall or whatever. I also didn't talk about Israeli actions that I think are out of bounds. And, perhaps some of you have been following the Land Day protests that have been going on for several weeks. There are many people, including Roger Cohen, who I quoted as saying, that he would support, that he thinks the price is worth it, right, the price to Palestinians. Still, he wrote a column this past week saying how nauseated he was. He didn't use the word nauseated, but how upset he was at Israel's attack on peaceful protests. So, that would be another talk. That would be another talk. What have the Palestinians done, and what have the Israelis done, and how should we feel about it? So that's not what my talk was about. My talk was about opening up the discussion. Okay.
Relating to open discussion, could you talk a little bit about the width and breadth and nature of the discussion of these issues within Israel?
I can't talk with very much detail about that. Not off the cuff. I might be able to if you ask me to, give another speech later. But no, I do know that the Israelis primarily have gone, just as we have in the United States, really, that the populace has gotten more and more right-wing. So I do know that the discussion in the public arena tends to be more and more right-wing. No tolerance for the Palestinian viewpoint. That's all. I don't have more details than that. If you want to invite me back, I'll be glad to prepare something.
Hi. Jamie?
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit more about when Zionism first came about? The Zionist movement called for the integration of the Arab population in Israel. What happened to that?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Could you say it again a little bit?
Well, when the Zionists first, in the late 1800s, they were very much for the integration of the Arab population in Israel.
Integration with the Arab population?
Yes. What happened with that?
Well, I'm not sure that that's 100% true.
Okay.
I would have to, if I were going to comment on that with any expertise or any confidence, okay, I would want to have footnotes available. But I do know that there were people in the Zionist movement who acknowledged that in order for Zionism to, for the Jews to have the state of Israel, they were going to have to push out the people who were already there. And in fact, there have Benny Morris, for example, who's a well-respected Israeli historian who's still living today, has published books where he said, you know, they had plans way before the Arabs attacked and on how to push the Palestinians out of their homes. And Benny Morris actually said, I do know this, although if you want the footnote, I'll have to get it later, that they actually stopped too soon. The reason we have all these problems in Israel is they didn't go far enough. They didn't get all the Palestinians out. So I know that there were probably, to address your point, I'm sure there were probably Zionists in 1890s and the early 1900s who thought, well, we can just all get along. I can't really...
Well, there was a lot of money put into the French Jewish fans. The Rothschilds and other very wealthy Jewish families paid a lot of money to the Palestinians for a lot of their property.
Well, I've heard that before, and maybe it's true, although I also know, without being able to document it this morning, that most of the land was just stolen and still is stolen today. It goes on today. You know, there's a whole process that they use to exclude Palestinians from their homes, and then they declare the home vacant, and then they seize it. So, you know, like I say, you know, I appreciate that comment. However, I would like to emphasize again that if you feel that that criticism of Israelis or the Zionists is unfair and that the Palestinians are the ones to blame for their situation, let's talk about that. Let's not make it off limits to talk about it.
Yes. It seems to me that the discussion about Zionism has been tied into anti-Semitism. Yeah. And that it seems to me, listening to what you had to say today, that these are two very different things. Zionism is you know, a philosophy, and Semitism is, you know, a race or a group of people.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, you know, talk a little bit about how one is used to justify the other, or you know, how that's used to obscure the whole
right.
subject?
Well, for sure, Zionists saw themselves as establishing, like I said earlier, the Zionists saw the establishment of the State of Israel as a Jewish state with preference to Jews, a refuge for Jews, as a way of trying to survive and get around anti-Semitism. Their idea was that since there has been anti-Semitism or anti-Jewishness, there has been persecution of the Jews for forever, that you know, we just need our refuge. We need our refuge. To say, though, as Ms. Gale said at the J Street organization, to say that Zionism is the only way to counteract anti-Semitism, she thinks is a mistake, and in fact, she personally thinks that that we should be able to at least talk about that, that perhaps Zionism is not the best way. If Zionism means that you have a state that denies rights, is not a democracy, and denies human rights to a whole group of people who had lived there also for millennia, if that is what Zionism needs to survive, then she's saying maybe that's not the best way to fight anti-Semitism.
There, I have so many questions. It's hard to know where to begin. But I find it hard to understand how you think Israel isn't a democracy when they have political parties, people vote for candidates. They had an election recently. There are Arabs in the Knesset. There are newspapers of all stripes in Israel. There are many other countries that shut down newspapers, opposition. So what is it about Israel that means that it's not democratic?
Well, it is largely democratic, as democratic as the United States is, I would say, for Jews. And for, there are, as you point out, there are Arabs on the Knesset, and they, and there are Arabs who are Israeli citizens. They're not Israeli nationals. They're not nationals, so there is a difference. And they do not enjoy the same rights. The Arabs in Israel proper do not enjoy the same rights as do Jews, any non-Jews, not just Arabs. But of course, what that leaves out is the, you know, millions of people who have been cordoned off into these open-air prisons. So what are you going to do with those people? They don't get to vote. They don't even get to leave. They don't even get to leave if they're in dire medical need. And they can sometimes make a petition to be able to leave. But then, you know, maybe they get their petition is granted and maybe it's not. You know, maybe they die because they can't get to medical treatment and maybe they don't. So there are millions of people in Gaza and the West Bank who are not allowed to vote. And those people are inhabitants of the land. So you can't say that it's a democracy if there's this whole segment of the population that is denied all human rights. And of course, Palestinians in Gaza and West Bank, they don't even have access to the Jewish courts. They go to military court, and the military courts convict Palestinians 98% of the time. So it's not a democracy if huge section. Otherwise, they could just open it up, right? They could open it up and everybody has have human rights, but they're not going to do that, or they don't want to do that. I'll put it that way. Yes.
Time Thank to go. You, Jamie. Thank you.
All right. Well, I will be in the library if anybody wants to talk further.
But I have one more question.
Oh, you have a question. I thought you were telling me to...
Oh, no, not at all.
Oh, you're the one.
I hope this isn't unfair to you, but there is another issue, a broader issue, or maybe it's simply a more local issue, that you do bring up several times, and that is the chokehold on the press. We are seeing all kinds of changes in what is allowable to be presented in the press. The loosening of the moral codes of not too long ago of what is allowable in the press. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the American press, not just in relation to Israel and Palestine, but also in relation to a change in philosophy.
Well, I mean, I can comment on it, although I'm just like you. I'm an interested party, and I'm not an expert on it. Of course, we all know that the media, more and more, both the print media, the newspapers, and the radio stations and the TV stations are more and more controlled by corporate America. And, you know, there was the recent scandal about Sinclair Broadcasting forcing the TV, announcers at their TV stations to read off this very pro-Trump message. So I think there has been a lot of damage to the media in all kinds of ways. That's one reason why I belong to a group called Friends of Community Media. So, I mean, I think that we should all, you know, a friend of mine says it over and over again, whatever your issue is, you should also... Your other issue should be opening up the free press. So I totally agree with that, you know, for whoever's got enough energy to have two issues, my hat's off to you. Okay.
Jamie, just a quick question. Where did the term anti-Semite come from? I mean, it's been bandied around for decades, but I don't know. Where did it come from? Because the reality is the word Semite means desert dweller. They're all Semites,
right?
The Arabs and the Jews.
Right. Well, not being an etymologist, I don't know. I think that's the right word, right, for people who know about words. Entomologist. Etymologist, right, there you go. But you're right, a lot of people bring that up, that anti-Semitism is really an unfortunate term because the Palestinians really are Semites too. So it's an unfortunate term, yeah. Does anybody else have a question? Okay. All right, well, thank you again. All right.
Let me present our official mug for the speaking of the Unitarian Forum.
Thank you very much.
Next week there will not be a forum. You're all expected to attend or invited to attend the church service at 11:15 next Sunday, but the Black Lives Matter group will be taking over the church for Saturday and Sunday, I think it is. And but thank you for coming to the forum, and welcome to go to the library if you'd like.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Can We Talk About Zionism? With Jamie Jackson. This program was recorded on Sunday, April 22nd at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within one day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.